welcome to Section 9. My name's Damien Hull.
And I'm Dorothy. And today we're going to talk about keeping what we have learned, shedding some light into WannaCry, and joining the dark side. So one of the big things that we have to consider when you're in IT is keeping the skills that you have. Because if you don't use them, you have a tendency to lose them. So why don't you tell us about your experience with that?
So yeah, I used to be Cisco and Juniper certified, and I used to do this for a living, right? Used to work for that ISP, and all day long, what did we do? Juniper, Cisco, Juniper, Cisco. And then we ended up going from some Cisco to all Juniper. And we were actually replacing Cisco gear with Juniper equipment. So what happened was I wasn't doing any Cisco for a while, and I only did Juniper. Then I left that and got a job not doing any of that. So most of my network engineering skills were kind of not used anymore. And then when I tried to go take that Cisco cert to renew all of my Cisco certs, you know, tried to do CCDP, and that was a disaster because I didn't give myself enough time to study for that. And then I hadn't used any of that in so long that it was kind of hard for me to figure out what was going on with those videos and my studying.
But you did share a story with me because you kept saying, oh, you know, I interviewed for this network engineering positions where they use Cisco. And you were having trouble, you know, you kept saying to me, do you remember that story that you told me?
Yeah, so I interviewed for this position and, you know, the recruiter's like, oh, your resume looks good. You have all these certs. This is going to be perfect for you. So when I got to the phone interview and I'm actually talking to an engineer, the person who's in charge of all of this, he's making it sound like this is a very important position. We have to keep this network up and running. And there's only going to be two of you on site at that one location. And then he starts asking about all of the things that you know, they're going to be doing, you know, questions that are talking about, or he's asking about how to configure some advanced features on Cisco devices. Some of these things I don't know about because I've never done it before. So there's that issue.
Mm-hmm.
But there's other things that I should know something about because I've done some of them. And yet I'm having issues trying to remember how all of these things go together because I don't use it anymore.
Right.
So then it's kind of one of those situations where, okay, you didn't get your cert, but what's the big deal? Doesn't really matter. You can't do it anyway. You know, you've lost that skill because you don't use it enough anymore. Now, I can still do some network engineering. That piece hasn't been lost yet, but some of the advanced stuff that I used to do in terms of configuring Juniper devices and Cisco devices, I don't know them anymore.
Well, and compounded with the fact that you know, technology moves really fast. If you're not working on Cisco, you're not going to move with the technology as well. So there's always that issue. For me, it's a little bit different because I'm not in IT. I go to a regular job, and then when I get off work, that's when I do my IT. And one of the things is, as I've been working on these projects, you know, that you've been assigning me, you know, I was doing really good. And one of the things that I pride myself on was subnetting. You know, I can do the CIDR notations, the host and everything, you know, some of it in my head. And you know this because we had this conversation last week. I was having issues, you know, with the host part of the equation. It's like, I knew how to do this and now I can't even remember where to begin. Why? Because I'm not doing it all the time. So this is something that if you're in IT, whether you are in an IT job and then you get specialized in one area and you have certifications that you don't use the material that you learn that way at work, you need to figure out how to maintain those skills because they are perishable skills. If you don't use them, you're going to lose them. If you don't keep up with what's going on, you know, you're going to lose it. And for people like me that are trying to get into IT, it's even more difficult because we're having to do the IT stuff without going to work in IT. So you have to constantly do it over and over again until you get that IT job. One of the things that I liked that you told me and that you shared with me, and I think that I like to pass that on, is listening to TWIT. You know, some of the TWIT shows that they have, because they have like the Windows show, what is it called?
Windows Weekly.
Windows Weekly. And then they have the know-how. And they talk about IT and they talk about the new things that are coming up in IT. And, you know, if you're driving to work, put that show on, listen to the podcast and listen to people, what the new things are on the technology that you're using. They even have one show called Windows Enterprise. So if you're working in an enterprise environment, it's a good way to keep up with the technology and just keep it fresh in your mind. For the rest of it, I think for me, I'm going to have to constantly do things over and over again until I get my IT job. So anyway, do you want to shed some light into WannaCry now?
Yeah. So let's jump into the WannaCry situation here.
So let me kind of say something about that, and then you can explain.
Well, hold on. Let's talk about some of the things that we need to clarify here.
Right.
So before you jump into that, because that's going to talk about some things that are on the list here. So we talk about WannaCry, but we don't talk about all of the things that kind of go along with that. So when you do your research on WannaCry, you're going to run into something called Eternal Blue, which is supposedly from the NSA. They're never going to say whether or not that's theirs or not. And that's supposed to be one of their little hacking tools that uses that SMB vulnerability that WannaCry takes advantage of. And then we have Double Pulsar, and I don't know where that actually fits into the whole big picture here. It's some kind of a back door, and I think that may be, I don't know if it goes along with Eternal Blue. A lot of these things, you know, you got to do some research on that and figure out how these things go together. But as you can see, WannaCry, you know, we talk about this as if, oh, that's it. Well, there's a lot of things that go along with that and that SMB vulnerability. And then we talk about, or we have here on our list, Shadow Brokers, which is the hacker group that a while back, they dumped a bunch of stuff onto the internet.
Yeah, and that's kind of, go ahead.
So they dumped Eternal Blue onto the internet, and also the Double Pulsar was part of their whole, you know, big internet dump that they did of stuff. And I don't even know all of what was in there, but those are the two things that stick out that kind of, anytime you do some research into WannaCry, not always, but, you know, I've seen a lot of articles online about WannaCry, and the next to it you see Eternal Blue and maybe Double Pulsar.
Right. So one of the things that I found, and we're going to put this in the show notes, we'll do the link to this thing, is it talks about in April of this year, the Shadow Brokers released the SMB vulnerability named Eternal Blue, which was part of that Microsoft Security Bulletin that you talked about on the last show. The MS-17-010. And one of the things, you know, it talks about the ransomware, how it takes advantage of the vulnerability to compromise the Windows machines. And, you know, the attack uses SMB version number 1 and TCP port 445 to propagate. And then the whole article goes into what it is, how it's used. It has a couple of examples, what happens after. So it was kind of interesting. So we're going to put in the show notes for you to take a look at that.
Yeah. And here's the thing that I don't know if this is true or not, but this is kind of my thinking. And I'll have to do some research on this because this is something I want to know. It could be that Eternal Blue was dumped out there onto the internet. And then we see WannaCry. So my thinking is, and I have to do homework on this because, again, I don't know if this is true or not, but maybe WannaCry came after Eternal Blue, and that, you know, the hackers saw Eternal Blue.
Well, that's what the article talks about. They, you know, after the Shadow Brokers put it out there, you know, it was that they reported the SMB vulnerability or what have you, then WannaCry used it to actually, you know, exploit it. So that's kind of what it is about, you know. But one of the things that I liked is that you did some further research on, you know, why they do this malware, how it works, why they get from it, you know, the joining of the dark side.
Oh, yeah. So let's jump into that joining of the dark side thing. Yeah. And I know I'm going to say something here you don't really care for, but I, this was just kind of a little thing that popped into my head. Hey, you know, why do the hackers do what they do? One of the reasons is money. And there's other reasons out there as well. But I'm thinking, okay, you know, money is a big reason, right? They want to get money from somebody. You know, either they're going in and they're stealing credit card information or whatever else. And now you have WannaCry or ransomware that's out there. And that's on the rise because it's relatively straightforward. You infect somebody's machine. It asks for money to decrypt your files because now you don't have access to them. And then you pay the ransom and then you get your files back. And then the hacker gets some money from you. So my thinking was, okay, how does that whole process work? Is it possible for me to quit my job and do something like that and actually make money on that? And I've heard some stories about how little people actually make from things like ransomware. But I want to know if this is possible. And I don't have any hacking skills, really. I mean, I'm not a programmer. So if you're going to be somebody who's going to say use ransomware, one of two things has to happen. Either you're going to write your own ransomware or you're going to get it from somebody else. So that brings up a whole new area of hacking that I kind of talked about when we got into Kali Linux, right? Because we have all these different tools that are in there. So you have this Linux distribution that's always updated, and all you have to do is run that, and all your hacking tools are right there. And, you know, we're on the good side, but you also have hackers there on the internet that have access to Kali Linux. They can download it just like we do, and they can use the same tools that we're using in our lab. So if you look at tools like Metasploit, even if you don't know a whole lot, and I started out knowing very little about Metasploit, but years ago, I went ahead and tried to use it against a Windows 7 system. And my first attempts didn't work. And what happened was, I ran into issues with that where, you know, different things just, it wouldn't let me hack into the system. And I had to make some modifications to break in. But it was still pretty straightforward. I could point and click my way into the system. And that was what was kind of shocking to me in my sort of world of not understanding how a lot of this stuff works. I went to the Windows 7 machine, turned off the antivirus because I couldn't bypass that. And there's a lot of people out there who never update their antivirus. So you have to think about that as well. And what did I do? I have my Metasploit in there. I have Armitage, which is the GUI front end. And what do? I point it at the Windows 7 machine. I scan it. And then I say, okay, let's try the Hail Mary attack. And what does the Hail Mary attack do? Without you knowing anything, it tries different exploits against that particular system that relate to some of the vulnerabilities it sees after you've done that scan. And if it's a Windows 7 system, it's going to try those Windows 7 exploits on there, again, based on what it sees in the scan, and try to break in. And then once you're in, you can escalate privilege. You can become the admin of that system. You can take screenshots of the desktop. You can turn on the webcam. If there's a microphone, you can record somebody talking. And nobody knows you're doing this. It's not like there's all these pop-ups that show up saying, hey, the webcam's on. Hey, somebody's taking a picture of your desktop. Hey, somebody's recording you the voice of your conversation with the microphone on the computer. It doesn't say anything like that. So it's pretty easy, even for somebody who doesn't know a lot about these different tools. So take that into consideration. And now, I mean, there's still going to be some difficulty trying to use this to make money because you're trying to hack into a larger organization. They're going to have all this security in place and you're going to have difficulty trying to get in. And so, you know, it's not as straightforward as I make it sound, but the tool is there and you can use that and the hackers have access. So from a security point of view, you know, as I'm playing that IT manager who wants to keep the organization safe, that's something I think you should take into consideration, that the hackers have access to all of this software that's pretty point and click. And these people are smart. So again, keep that in mind. And then there may be other people out there who want to just get into this kind of thing. It's not that hard to learn how to do something. And we're going to go into an area of this that's kind of interesting. I ran into some of this stuff as I was reading emails and thinking about how all of that works and relating that to some of the things I was doing with Kali Linux and our CVEs and the vulnerabilities and all of this stuff that I'm trying to learn with penetration testing and breaking into systems. So in IT, we have this thing called SaaS, which is software as a service, right? And we have some of that.
Right.
So we have Google Docs, right? I can go in there and I can do a spreadsheet. I can do a Word document. I mean, it's Google Docs. So it's, the word processor they have in there. And then we also have
Lucidchart,
where we do our network diagrams. So that's software. And usually when we talk about SaaS, it's in the cloud. I don't know if that's always true. But typically, it's in the cloud, you access it through a web browser, and then you can go and do whatever it is the software does. And that's a company providing you with software as a service. We also now have RAS, which is ransomware as a service. So how does all of this work? Well, I haven't actually seen it in action, so I don't really know if there's like a website you go to, if it's software that you have to download and then it talks back to different servers, or how all of that works. But we now have, let's see here, let me take a look at our list. We have Fatboy, we have Ransom 32, and then we have Satan. And the last two are from 2016. Fatboy is from this year. And these are examples of ransomware as a service. And we're going to take a look at Fatboy. And again, I've never downloaded any of this thing. And by the way, we're just talking about this as a hypothetical. Okay, if I were going to do this, this is, you know, this is some of the stuff that you're going to see.
Yeah, and this is the part that I don't like, because, you know, I'm not really fond of joining the dark side. And I truly understand the value of you putting your black hat on and going, okay, I need to look at it from the dark side, from where they're coming from and what they're trying to do. So don't try this at home.
No. And I should point out here, yeah, that we record these shows over and over to try to get them right.
Right.
So the first time we did this, you were like, well, you're going to end up in that cell with somebody else and I'm going to have to visit you in prison.
You decided, you're like, okay, so if I want to make some money and I want to do this, and I'm like, wait a minute, and if you want to be on handcuffs and be in prison because the guy actually selling the ransomware that it sells it to you had a Russian accent, wasn't that your friend was telling you that?
Oh, yeah. So I have to tell that story.
Yeah,
you do. You know, we're talking about RAS, but I had a security expert talk about purchasing malware from the dark web.
Right.
And so this is an interesting story because it goes back to this whole idea that hacking is now becoming point and click. Simple. You don't have to know anything. You just get it from the right people and then you can do whatever you want. So he goes online and he was doing this more as a research project. And this was more work related. So again, don't do this. You're going to get yourself into trouble if you do that. Stay away from all that stuff. But he went to the dark web, and I don't know what website he went to. He's not going to share that information with people. But he said it was like going to Amazon. You go in there, you pick and choose what you want, and the kind of features you want to have in there and all of this. There's tech support options. And then at the end of it all, it says, okay, here's how much you owe. Go ahead and put in your credit card information or whatever it is you're going to do. Maybe you pay by Bitcoin so it can't be tracked. So he pays, and then he gets his malware. Now, I don't know if this was ransomware, but it was some kind of malware. And he said he put together a virtual machine, and he went to try it out. And unfortunately for him, it didn't work. And he also got included with all of this, you know, package deal he bought, a phone number. So he decides to go and call the phone number. And somebody with a Russian accent answers the phone. And he tells them, hey, I just purchased this malware. It doesn't work. And they say, okay, what do you mean it doesn't work? It's supposed to. Let me try that. So they go ahead and take a look at the code that he purchased, and they try to run it, and they go, oh, yeah, no, it doesn't work. You got a pen? Write this number down. This is your ticket number. So he writes it down, and this is just like how you would do tech support anywhere else. He has a ticket number, so he can call back and say, hey, I got my ticket number here. Where's my malware? Is it working yet? Have you fixed it? And so they said, you know, here you go. We will email you in a couple days because, you know, you have support with this. This is fine. You don't have to worry about this. We'll fix it and send it to you. So a couple days later, he gets an email or whatever it is that they gave him, and he tries the malware and it works just fine. And he says the whole experience was just weird because it was like commercial software. It was like he was dealing with professionals. And he says, most likely this is the Russian mob. And this is what they're doing now. They're selling malware just like you would buy it on Amazon.
And the European part of me, it'd be going, oh, yeah, right. You know, they're sending me the malware. They're putting a backdoor over here. They're doing it. Oh, I just would be, bells will be just.
Well, and that's why he did it in a virtual machine, sandboxed that thing, and then that's it, you know.
Right.
Because, you know, you never know what you're going to be getting with that.
So let's get back to Fatboy. Tell us about Fatboy.
Okay, so we're going to take a look at what's inside of Fatboy. And again, just like how this guy got the malware with tech support, Fatboy comes with tech support. It's ransomware. And the ransom is determined based on the victim's location.
What does that mean?
And this is where I think this thing gets really interesting. And this is where the hackers are getting really sophisticated. And I think the malware or the ransomware people have done an excellent job of not overcharging people. And a lot of people had talked about this when ransomware first kind of started coming out. You can't just say, okay, I'm going to ask for $1 million. If they don't have $1 million, they don't have it. They're never going to pay it, right? But if you ask somebody for $300, well, maybe that's something somebody can afford. And so they pay that. And the way they're going to make their money is by having multiple people pay that $300, right? So instead of getting it all at once as a maybe, you get 300 here, 300 there, and then it all adds up to something. And Fatboy uses something called the Big Mac Index or Burgernomics. And this was something that came out, I think it was in the 70s or something like that, where they wanted some economists decided they want to, you know, kind of be funny and explain how some of this stuff works. And what they were trying to do here is pick an item that you have in lots of different countries and take the average price of that and show how the same product costs different amounts in different countries based on their economy and what people can afford in that economy. So here you have,
A Big Mac.
The Big Mac. So I went online and I looked up the price of a Big Mac in different countries. So in the U.S., and this, by the way, is for this year, and this is in the U.S., we have $5.04. In China, it's $2.79. And in the United Kingdom, it's $3.94. Why is this important? Because automatically, Fatboy is going to take this stuff into consideration using the Big Mac Index or Burgernomics, and it's going to figure out where in the world the...
So wait a minute. So let me think about this. So you're saying that if somebody purchases the ransomware in the U.S., it's going to cost one thing. If they purchase it in China, it's going to cost another thing.
No. So here's how it works.
Okay.
I purchase
Fatboy. Oh, no, wait. I got it. Yeah. I see. So let's say that I do ransomware in the U.S., I'm going to charge 300 Bitcoin here versus if I run that ransomware in China, I would charge a different amount.
Right. So maybe it's $300 in the U.S., it's $200 in China or whatever, you know, or maybe it's even $100 in China. And then you go to someplace like Mexico, maybe you charge $50 or whatever it is. So it's a different amount in different countries based on how much that country, you know, the average wealth of that country, whatever you want to call it, the Burgernomics. So you're not overcharging somebody. And by doing it that way, you're more likely to get paid because it's not an excessive amount that those people can't afford to pay. In this case, You're making sure that you're not overcharging somebody and having them go, oh, I can't afford that. Let's not pay.
Got it. So you get something that's important to them, their data, their pictures of their family or what have you. And then you just kind of put a price that even if it's a little bit higher than what they can afford, you know they're going to want to go for it and try to get this stuff.
Yeah, and then they had a number in here, and this is kind of an estimate of how much this person has made. So the author of Fatboy has made some money from this because he's done his own little ransomware campaign. And so since February 2017, he's made about $5,321.
But you said this is a 2017 ransomware.
Yes, it is.
So let's just say that he put it out in January, so by February he'd already made $5,000.
Since February, so he started in February.
Okay.
And February to now, roughly.
Okay. Got it.
I mean, I don't know when the actual article was published. It's mm-hmm. recent, so he's made about $5,321.
Wow.
So I mean, that's not a huge amount. I mean, if you think, because this is the kind of idea that I had in my head, and maybe some people think the same thing. They're going to be making millions. Well, not necessarily. I mean, if you get a day job, you're going to do better than what he's making here, right?
Right.
I mean, you're not going to be sitting on the couch in your mansion with $5,000 since February.
Yeah, but if you reach a lot of people all over the world, I mean, that adds up.
Well, you know, that's where he's at and he's got his ransomware. So who knows? But let's take a look at some of the features we have in here, because I think the really interesting thing is the feature set. And this is what...
This is for the people that buy Fatboy. Is that what you're saying?
Right. You know, okay. So like if you go online and you want to purchase something, I mean, we used to go to the store and buy it, and then, you know, you pick up the box and it has all the features on there. Now you just go online, you read the website features, and you go, okay, I want that, and I buy it.
Okay, so what do they have?
So this is what the guy wrote. You know, he says here, we invite you to take part in a partnership for the monetization of downloads with help of the Fatboy Encryption Software, limited partnership. So basically what you're doing is you're going to be a partner with this guy when you buy his software. And I don't know exactly what the thing looks like. It may be something you install on your system. It could be a website. I'm thinking it may be something you install on your system, and then you get some sort of panel that shows up. And then it says here, product description. Base load, 15.6 kilobytes, written in C++. I don't know if that really means anything to me, because I'm not a programmer. And then it says, active crypto locker development and support. So basically, he's got some encryption software that's going to encrypt all the files, right? And he's going to be doing something with that. Works on all Windows OS, x86 and 64. So it's going to be 32-bit systems and 64-bit systems. And then we have multi-language user interface with 12 languages. That's a lot. I think he went, you know, tried to cover all his bases in terms of people who are going to want to buy his malware and then have access to that so they can make their money. And then we have encrypts every file with AES-256 with individual keys. This is where it gets interesting. Individual keys. So that means that if I buy Fatboy and your system gets infected, that system is going to generate a key to encrypt all of your files. The next person's system gets infected, it's going to generate a key and encrypt all those files.
So a different key.
A different key every time you get infected.
So it's not that you can use one key for all of it. It just has to be your own individual key.
It's your own individual key. So you can't go to your neighbor and say, give me your key, I'm going to decrypt my files.
Got it.
It doesn't work that way.
Smart, if you want to collect from everybody instead of one.
Right. And then it says here, all keys are encrypted with RSA 2048. So it generates a key to do the encryption of the files, and then it encrypts the key with RSA. So now you have to try to somehow decrypt the key
before you can decrypt the files. Wow.
And there's no way you're going to crack that. There's no way you're going to crack any of this. You know, I wouldn't even bother trying. I mean, so this is where the backup comes into play, right?
Right.
Those people who pay are the ones that don't have a backup. So the next thing on here, it says, comfortable partner panel with full statistics by country and time. So there's a panel in there that you're going to see with a bunch of statistics. And then it says detailed information on each individual client is in the partner panel. So all of the clients you have out there, which is going to be the malware that's been infecting different systems, is going to be listed on there. Scans all disks and network folders. And here's where it gets kind of scary. So if you have one system and you have a Linux laptop, so it doesn't apply to you because this is only going to affect Windows systems, but you have a laptop with two hard drives in it, right?
Right.
So this thing would scan all your hard drives, not just the C drive. So
it would encrypt all of them.
All of them. So it would look for files on all the drives on your system and encrypt the files that it would know something about. And then if you work in a business environment, where they have, let's say, a Windows domain, lots of users, what are you going to have? A file server someplace. Network shares. So on my system at work, I have several network drives that are mapped to my system. So if my system were to get infected with Fatboy, what happens? All the files,
server.
Right. All the files on my laptop would be encrypted. And then the files on the server would also get encrypted. So now, not only is my laptop encrypted, but now the company data is encrypted.
Wow.
And so now we, you know, if we don't have a backup, what do? We have to pay.
Right. Wow. That's just wicked.
And then it says new Bitcoin wallet number for each client. So each client has a separate Bitcoin wallet that it's going to send money to. And I don't know how all of that works. I used to own some Bitcoin, but it was kind of hard for me to figure out what was going on, and then I got rid of it. So I don't have this huge knowledge of how Bitcoin works, but I know there is a wallet that you have to have where you store your Bitcoin. And I think this is a way to make it even harder for somebody to track you down because it's a separate wallet for each client. And then let's see, what else do we have here? Software deletes after payment. So I get it, you know, my system gets infected. I realize I don't have a backup. Now I have to pay. So I pay. And then my files are decrypted. I have access. And then this thing deletes itself. So if I'm a company, I want to go to the FBI and I want to say, hey, we got infected with this thing. You need to come and take a look at our systems.
Right.
There's not going to be anything there for them to find. It's deleted. It's right. Gone. You got rid of the evidence. Or, well, the hacker got rid of the evidence by deleting all the files relating to that malware.
Right.
So if I'm the person who is using Fatboy to make money, I'm sitting on the couch while this thing is already covering my tracks. You're not going to find anything.
Right.
So let's see, where were we at? Bitcoin software. Okay, instant transfer of funds to the partner after the victim pays for decryption. So I don't have to do anything. You get infected, you pay, it deletes the file, decrypts your stuff, sends me the money, and all I'm doing is sitting on the couch, sipping my coffee, doing what I do throughout my day, collecting money.
Waiting to be arrested.
Yeah.
Because the guy with the Russian accent that sold you the ransomware, they're not going to reach him.
So now you have support for more than 5,000 file extensions. So I think what happens here is that it's searching for things like, you know, .exe, .zip, .docx.
JPEG.
You know, the JPEG. Mm. And it's going to see those file types and then encrypt them. So there's 5,000 different file types.
Well, you got to have at least that many to be able to encrypt. Because you never know what kind of files people have.
No, you don't know what kind of, so that you have to have that in there.
Right.
And then, of course, it's talking about, you know, automatic price adjustment depending on where they live and, you know, what country.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says here, extended help with step-by-step instructions for payment. And then we have partner details, support and guidance for partners. Wait, through you Jabber.
You can put that on the show notes as well, right?
Yeah. All this is going to go in the show notes.
Yeah. So people can take a look at it. But it's interesting how evil... I mean, it's really scary, you know, when you think about, you know, what they're able to do. And, you know, they get better every day.
Yeah. So as you can see, you know, if I were to go buy this, I don't know anything about programming. I don't know anything about C++. I don't know about any of that stuff. And yet I could still use this and collect money. Now, you know, I kind of jokingly thought, well, I could do that and just quit my job and collect a bunch of money. But again, you know, since, when was it, February?
Yeah.
He only made like $5,000.
Well, let me ask you this. Does it say how much Fatboy is?
It doesn't say how much the software actually costs. And so you'd have to go online and find out, you know, somewhere somebody may have posted, you know, what the price tag is for Fatboy.
No, I'm just wondering because he's making money out of getting partners into this ransomware, and then the partners get a percentage of what he collects. But I just have to wonder how much the software is.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing that you bring up here, because it says conversion level of partner traffic makes up 3 to 15% of overall downloads.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, because sometimes they'll say, okay, you know, if you release some ransomware, and the ransom comes in, you know, like you get automatically paid, maybe he gets a percentage of that.
Correct.
I don't know if that's exactly how this works, but there was talk when I was doing some research on this that that might be how some of these things work.
What I was thinking is you invest in his ransomware and he deploys it versus you actually deploying that. So maybe as a partner, one of the requirements is that you also release the ransomware.
I think that's what, you know, he kind of talks about there in the beginning. We invite you to take part in a partnership for the monetization of downloads with the help of Fatboy encryption software. So I think what you're trying to do there is you may have to help propagate the malware across the internet to get more people to you know, be part of that whole scheme of having to pay to get their files back. Wow. But again, you know, I don't exactly know how all of that works, but the big hurdle of saying, well, I'm not a programmer, I can't do this. Well, that's not a thing anymore. You buy something like Fatboy and it has all these fancy features. And I will say this, some of this stuff has better features or, you know, than better features, better support than even some commercial software. You know, there's updates, there's tech support, you know, all of it works in different languages. A lot of commercial applications charge you an arm and a leg. And when you try to call tech support, who's there? Nobody.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's just, you know, I can tell you sometimes that the development of software in different countries, you know, they have more leeway than we have. I mean, even our penetration testers here in the U.S., their hands are pretty much tied because they have to put things on a document of what they're going to do. They're restricted by those parameters. And if they find something else, you know, on the way to do what they went ahead and said, okay, this is what they got permission to do, they can't pursue it. And I can honestly tell you that sometimes the reason why those international hackers, for lack of a better word, are better is because they don't have those restrictions and they can just go and try to figure out, oh, I can do this, oh, I can do that. You know, not that I'm, you know, advertising or advising that people, you know, would just go and do penetration testing however they want. I understand the value of having those parameters, but I think sometimes the restrictions that you can bring to your company and say, wow, it's much worse than what you think. And had I been able to pursue this, but it wasn't in the parameters, you know, I would have been able to tell you how far you've been compromised. I don't know. You know, I'm kind of on the fence on that. I really don't know what to think.
Well, but you're talking about, you know, hackers versus people doing penetration testing as a job.
Right.
That's a different situation.
But the fact of the matter is this. And granted, maybe that's my European opinion of it. If you are out to see if you can penetrate a system, I think you should act like a hacker. You should, you know, put your, like you said, your black hat on and just go out there and see what you can do. That's the only time you're ever going to know that, yeah, I can own this network and then some. You know, if you're babying yourself with a set of parameters to say, okay, I want to see if this part of the network is, you know, is penetrable, and then, you know, how do you really know that you're fully secure? Not that you're going to be fully secure because there's no such a thing without the suffering of production. But what I'm saying is they're getting in because they don't have those restrictions. And I think, it, you know, for a penetration tester, I think they should have free rein within reason. You know, I'm not saying go destroy the network and go do something. I mean, maybe you can record it as it goes along. I don't know how the whole thing works. But I really think sometimes those restrictions, you know, hinder your ability to see how secure your network is.
So I will bring up a little story here.
Okay.
When I took my second SANS course, which was the, so there's the GSEC, mm-hmm. and then there's GCED.
Right.
So it's the enterprise version or the, it's like the level two of the GSEC. So GSEC is covering, you know, basic security and how you make sure your organization is safe. The second one, the GCED, talks more about, you know, advanced features that you can add to the network. We're talking about things like intrusion detection and some other, you know, fancy tools you might have. So the person who's teaching the course, and I did this online by myself, so, you know, I didn't actually go to an event. But the interesting thing about that, and it goes to your point, is that this guy does penetration testing for a living, the instructor for the course. And he brought up an issue that he has whenever he does a pen test. Most of the time, the client does not want him to do social engineering as part of the pen test. And he's like, you're crazy not to do that. That's how they get in.
Especially, you know, the weakest thing in your organization is your user. And social engineering, it's critical for that kind of thing because you don't know if your people are trained right.
Yeah, and he said, look, if I do social, I'm getting in.
Yeah.
There's no way around that. And then there was another thing that somebody brought up, and I can't remember where I saw this, but there was a thing somebody did, and they said, they put this little email together, and it was part of a test for the company. And it said, just kind of a joke, right? And the thing said, do not click. And so when they sent it out, and there was other stuff in there, but it said, please do not click, or some such thing like that. In big letters, do not click. Well, they got a fair number of people to click, even though it said, do not click. So the point there is that, as you said, the end user is the company's
weakest point.
Because even when it says don't click, what do? They click. And what was funny about the whole thing is that who clicked?
The CEO.
No way. So, you know, it was execs that clicked. And what's on the exec's laptop? What's on their computer? All the juicy bits that the hackers want. And if it's ransomware that ends up on there, you know, maybe you don't have a backup for the latest thing they just finished working on. Well, now what happens?
Yeah.
You got to pay.
But here's the funny thing. You have your CEO. Like in my place of business, we got this people. We have certain people, and I'm sure that they're all over the offices that are especially nosy, and they want to be on everybody's business. You know, the kind of people that you want to kind of have a nose on a tray and go, here, I found your nose in my business kind of thing. And if you put malware on a USB and you label it payroll for accounting department or payroll for whatever department, you don't think they're going to look at it? They're going to take that puppy. They're going to put it in there. I want to see how much so-and-so is making, you know? So I don't understand people that wouldn't want to do social engineering, because to me, to identify the weakest people in my organization to make sure that I don't lose my business, I would think that would be something crucial.
No, yeah. And so, you know, we're just doing this as an experiment to see how all of this kind of goes together. And how does it work? If I'm somebody who doesn't understand how this stuff works, I can't write my own application to do things like WannaCry or Fatboy. You know, I just don't know how to do that. But I can go online. I can buy these things. I can make them work for me.
Yeah.
You know, it's point and click. And I think that the takeaway here is that while I now realize I'm probably not going to get rich if I do that, most likely I'm going to end up in prison, you know, because the $5,000 in that amount of time, that's not enough. You know, I make more than that at my current job. So I think that's something that you have to take into consideration. And but I also think that if you're looking at this from a security point of view, be aware that this stuff is out there and it's point and click. Even when you talk about Metasploit, if you have a vulnerable system out there and you haven't patched it and the hacker has Metasploit, it's not going to take them too long to get in.
Right.
As long as the right exploit code is on there, they may be finding a way to get in. And once they're in, they can do what they want. Because when I did it, like I said, it didn't take that much to gain full access to the system. It was like a couple of commands, boom, done.
Right.
And I can take video and pictures and whatever else I want to do with that. So be aware that this stuff is out there. Be aware that Fatboy is out there and it's now point and click. So I think you're going to see a lot more of this happen, and it's going to be a lot more of the things that maybe not necessarily kind of like WannaCry, but maybe. Because it's so easy to do it now. You got these people just creating this stuff and selling it, and then, you know, anybody can buy it.
I mean, it's kind of interesting that, you know, my thought, what's going through my mind right now is that if I was a software developer and I would go, wow, I created this wonderful software for people to use in a legitimate way, and my thought would be, how can I use it for evil? You know, how is that hacker going to look at my software, kill my baby, use it for evil, and... you know, I wouldn't like that. But at the same time, you have to be conscious of things that when it comes to IT, you know, you have to take the good with the bad, and you have to realize that you have to be aware that that is out there for you to be able to do what you need to do for your system. And that's important.
Yeah, yeah. And you have to be aware that the hackers have access to all of this.
Well, yeah.
And so do you have anything else?
I don't. Do you?
I think that's it for now. If you want to take a look at our show notes, you can go to section9.us, and we will have links to information about WannaCry and the double pulsar and all that stuff in there. We'll also have links to Fatboy and some of the other malware that we've been talking about. And then if you have any comments or questions, you can email us at info@section9.us.
Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for listening.